Orega Wine-Tefera was surprised 10 years ago when she found herself running an orphanage out of her home in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. She was taking in children whose parents had died of AIDS. At the time, no medicines were being made available to fight the disease, and most middle-class Ethiopians shunned anyone linked to it for fear of catching it themselves. Melissa Faye Green wrote a moving account of Orega Wine-Tefera's efforts to help those orphan kids. It's called There Is No Me Without You, and it brought Ms. Green to my show earlier this year, and here it is again. I started by asking Melissa Faye Green how many Ethiopian children are believed to have been orphaned by AIDS.
In Ethiopia, something around 1.25 million now.
1.25 million people. So that means at least 1.25 million died, and a lot more have, perhaps.
Leaving these children. The estimates are that maybe 13% of the children in Ethiopia are orphans.
Now, why Ethiopia? I understand South Africa is a very populous country, but Ethiopia isn't the second most populous country in Africa.
It's hugely populous, and it has nonstop war. The front with Eritrea, and now they're fighting rebels in the south. War opens the door to AIDS.
And what led you to make that first trip to Africa? Were you just going as a journalist who wanted to write about this, or were you thinking about, because you're somebody who seems to love to adopt children, you're thinking of adopting kids?
It happens that my husband and I are interested in adoption. We have 4 children by birth. A few years ago, when the oldest went off to college, we were heartbroken. We had a feeling
of
empty nest at the idea of 3 children in the house, so we brought in a little boy from Bulgaria. My husband told people we were backfilling. I told people it was because we already owned every Lego set and we hadn't gotten our money's worth out of them yet. A couple of years later, our second oldest prepared to leave home for college. You know, we haven't renovated the basement yet, I protested, but he was leaving anyway. And it was at that moment I was reading the terrible news about Africa. The UN was calling Africa a continent of orphans. So I suddenly wondered, can you adopt a child from Africa? It opened a path for me behind the big numbers with all the zeros.
9 altogether between your own and the adopted?
Yes, I'm almost embarrassed. Yes, it's a ridiculous number. We have 4 children by birth and 5 by adoption, 4 of whom now are from Ethiopia.
So how did you meet Orega Wine-Tefera? Were you going there to look for some Ethiopian children?
When I first went over, it was with the double mission, first of meeting a little girl named Helen, with whom we had been matched by an adoption agency, and secondly, to report for the New York Times Magazine on the state of some of the world's orphan children. I did not meet Mrs. Harrigan that first trip, but I heard about her, a middle-class, middle-aged woman who suddenly, through the tragedies in her own life, had almost accidentally opened the door to orphan children and was housing children in an old trailer and opening manila files on each child who arrived.
Her husband had died of a heart attack, and her 23-year-old daughter had died of AIDS. And she was just ready to go off and die on her own?
She was. She was a middle-aged, middle-class woman. She'd worked for Addis Ababa University. Her late husband was a high school principal. Already I was interested because it's not the cliche of Ethiopia. Mostly you read that Ethiopians are starving or they're supermodels or they're Olympic gold medalists. But there are other stories, and this woman is none of those. She's just sort of a plump, older, middle-class woman. She lost her daughter to AIDS, was shattered, tried to leave the world, tried to enter the church in seclusion. And at that moment, the church said, we have a 15-year-old girl here. She's got nothing. Would you take her? And that was the beginning for Harrigan of opening her door.
How did Harrigan's friends feel about her decision to take in these AIDS orphans?
They were scandalized. At that moment, the lack of knowledge and terror of AIDS spread even to the children of AIDS, even children who were not infected. The stigma was terrible, and the fear that the children spread the disease was terrible. It's where we were in the 1980s, if we remember. Suddenly this monstrous disease surfaced.
So she took in 2 teenagers and then young girls. How long before a whole bunch of kids started to arrive? The word was out. Here, there's this crazy woman who's taken in kids who are AIDS orphans.
Right. She took in first a teenage girl, then a teenage boy. Then 2 weeks later, the same church called and said, we have 2 6-year-old girls. So she took them. The same church called 2 weeks later and said, we have 4 more children. Now Harrigan said, wait a minute. I'm feeling much better. You were right. I shouldn't have left the world. Really, she thinks it's all about her still. So she's like, you know, it's all good. I'm good. Thanks. See you around. And they said, but there are 4 children. And she said, well, maybe I can take one. I don't know how to choose. No, Mrs. Harrigan, they laugh. We need you to take all the children. And she said, why can't you ask someone else? There is no one else, the church said, because she had been pushed to the wall, didn't care if she lived or died, so she didn't care about the stigma.
And then there were local government had needs. There were parents, I'm sure, who thought, I'm going to die. And there's this woman who'll take in kids.
Right. There's been about 350 children now have crossed her courtyard. Now, she's not unique in Africa now. She's not unique in Ethiopia. She was one of the first. And for me, it was a way into the story of the lives of these children.
Now, you said that they didn't necessarily, they weren't necessarily HIV positive, but some were, weren't they?
Some were.
And that's another story. It's one thing to take in healthy kids. It's another to take in kids who are infected, especially when they bear a serious stigma.
Right. She took in some babies who she believed to be HIV positive because their mothers had been. She nursed them most tenderly and slept with them and wore them in a sling, and the babies became healthy. What had happened, in fact, was those babies had not been infected.
They test positive when they're born sometimes because they have some antibodies they picked up from their mothers.
That's exactly right. So she thought she had cured them through loving kindness and mothering. So then she thought she'll try it with older children and took in older HIV positive children. Well, it turned out she hadn't cured the babies. You can't cure them without medicine. Suddenly she had older children who were going to die.
She's also a widow with no real means of support. How did she pay for all of this?
People in the neighborhood helped. Farmers came into town and dropped off, you know, a load of corn. I got tangled up in my own story because I wrote about Mrs. Harrigan for Good Housekeeping magazine, and Good Housekeeping readers sent to her $10 and $20 at a time with little notes that said, we didn't know. They sent her almost $100,000. So suddenly, she trades her one little brick house for two very nice homes. She rents out a gorgeous bed and breakfast. She's got a van. She's really quite well established. But then terrible rumors began to spread because people didn't know where all that money had come from.
Well, she is really doing this in an informal way. These sorts of things generally have some kind of institutional basis. She's inventing as she goes along.
She is.
That gets you in a lot of trouble.
It does. She's completely untrained, unlicensed. And it finally happened in her orphanage. What happens in orphanages around the world when there are vulnerable children crowded in together, which is that there was a case of child molestation within her orphanage. She tried to cover it up. The result of that was about 2 weeks before I was turning in the manuscript, she called me from prison in Addis Ababa. So the book took a bizarre turn that I had not hoped for.
Now, she tried to cover it up because she thought that it would cause trouble for her. She didn't have... This is an unlicensed orphanage. She did get rid of the kid who molested the other boys, but that's not the same thing as going to the police, which is what she should have done.
Right, and she didn't get medical examinations for the two boys who were molested by a young man.
Were they okay?
They were fine.
But still, she hadn't done that. And she said she regretted not having sought medical treatment for them at the time.
Yeah, later when she was in jail, she was really sorry. I came to think of her the way I thought about my grandmother in the 1950s in Macon, Georgia, who had a ladies' ready-to-wear store. What if she heard that the elevator boy molested a customer's son? My grandmother also would have said, never speak of it again, because the element of homosexuality was so terrifying to a middle-aged Ethiopian Orthodox woman that they found it unspeakable. Everyone says we don't have that here. That's not in this country.
She's already dealing with enough stigma as it is with all the AIDS. My guest is Melissa Fay Green. Her book, There Is No Me Without You, was published last year in hardcover, now available in paperback from Bloomsbury. And it is the story of this woman who somehow found herself with a whole bunch of kids. You said 300 or so at one point?
Right. Not at one time. Kids had moved through the house.
But still, she had a lot. And she said she liked it better when there were only a few because she could get to know them. After a while, she was just pretty much running a youth hostel.
I know. She's exhausted. She lives 24 hours a day, 7 days a week with, 60 children.
Didn't she also say that she kind of liked being in prison for a little while because she could sleep?
Yeah, she got to rest there. I can identify with this now. The last two boys we adopted came from Harrigan's house. Their pictures are actually in my book. I did not know I was going to be their mother, and they arrived this summer. And I'm not looking for prison, but it's kind of nice to be on the book tour. It's more restful than being home.
You've said that when you first knew Harrigan Tafera, she seemed saintly to you, almost like Mother Teresa. So have all the complications, the more recent problems, changed your opinion of her?
Well, they did. And I went through a time of being bitterly angry at her because I asked her about the incident of molestation. I flew over because I'd heard about it. And she looked me in the eyes and promised me it had not happened. And she explained that it was simply the result of a bad dream that a boy had. And I believed her. She held my hand and looked me in the eyes. So I wrote it up in that way. Then she calls me from jail. Whoops. So when she was released from jail, I flew back over to get the real story. But I was really mad for a while. Then a friend of mine said, and I don't know if this is a cliche or not, but it was a lifeline to me. My friend said, you know, they say even Mother Teresa was no Mother Teresa. And I thought, okay, that's all right. So she's not a saint, but she still has saved hundreds of lives anyway.
She was also accused by Ethiopian authorities of child trafficking.
Yeah.
She was getting money when she sent these orphans off, which is kind of selling babies, isn't
it? Right, but that was not true. And that was a result of people trying to figure out where this money was coming from. It's a nation which is largely illiterate. You don't have a lot of good housekeeping readers there. The concept that in another country people read a magazine story about her and sent money was inconceivable. It was simpler to understand, well, what does she have a lot of? Children, she must be selling them. But that was not true.
In this book, you come down rather hard on the large multinational drug companies. Are you convinced, as has been suggested, that the drug companies have committed crimes against humanity by artificially keeping the prices of antiretroviral drugs out of reach for the majority of Africans infected with HIV/AIDS?
Yes, I would subscribe to that view, that there have been crimes against humanity and that people have profited on this vast human misery. However, the current issue is really not that so much in that the generic drug companies have brought the prices down, and groups like the William J. Clinton Foundation and the Gates Foundation and the Global Fund have brought the drugs into Africa. The problem now is what they call the healthcare infrastructure. The clinics and hospitals and doctors and nurses aren't there to get the drugs to the people.
But it still is shocking when you compare the prices. GlaxoSmithKline's Retrovir cost almost $3,900 per year. The generic versions cost $105
yeah.
a year. How can that be justified, $3,900? I could see $1,000 even because they invented it.
Well, they always justify the high prices by saying it's the cost of research and development. But the drug companies won't release their figures of how much they spend, really, on research and development. Most of these drugs were developed at public expense. They were developed by NIH, by public universities. So that's where the expense of inventing the drugs came. What we know the drug companies do is spend phenomenal amounts of money on advertising.
When did the generic antiretroviral drugs first become available?
Just a few years ago. It's pretty new, and it was they came first from India and from Brazil, from countries daring to break the monopoly of the global companies.
So we can assume that there would have been a lot fewer orphans if these drugs had been available 10 years ago.
Exactly. And it wasn't that the big drug companies wanted to keep the drugs out of the hands of poor Africans. It wasn't that. But they wanted to protect the rich markets, and they didn't want to risk selling the drugs for $100 in Cameroon or Malawi and have that infiltrate into France or into the U.S.
What will happen when a second line of these drugs are needed?
That's where we are right now, and they're locked up by the pharmaceutical companies under patents. It's the same struggle right now. As the first-line drugs become less effective for an individual, those second-line drugs are now hugely expensive.
For a long time, people didn't want to have themselves tested for fear of finding out that they were positive and then having to face all the consequences. Has the availability of these drugs changed that in any way?
It has, Leonard. Wherever the medical care enters, the stigma falls away. When you've got this monstrous disease in your midst that it's unclear where it came from and it's inevitably fatal and you're going to die a painful, horrible death, people believe God sent it. And why could someone suffer so much? It must be you're being punished by God. But where the health care enters and suddenly you can take pills to prevent your children from getting it, you can get shots, you can live a fairly normal life, suddenly, all right, it's a disease. You know, it's not punishment for sin, it's a disease.
What's happened to the Ethiopian kids who you brought to Atlanta, to your home in Atlanta?
They're doing fabulously. Our daughter Helen is now 11. She's, you know, school president. She's a jazz dancer. She's preparing for her bat mitzvah. She's just every wonderful thing. The kids, we whisper and say that we had to adopt to get athletes. I wouldn't want all my older children to hear that. But with these kids, you know, they spend about 2 weeks with us, and then they're recruited for elite soccer teams, and off they go. They're wonderful.
Because they already grew up kicking a soccer ball around.
They did. And they grew up in loving families. They were robbed of their parents by disease. They were loved children.
Are there children wandering around the streets of Addis Ababa?
Addis Ababa, it's a hard one. There's an estimate of 10,000 children in Addis Ababa living underground. The children are living in sewers and under the streets. There's still a vast crisis of orphans all over the continent.
And what's happened to Heroguin Tefera? She was in prison for how long?
Just a few weeks. She's back at home. She's so tired and cranky now that she is scaling back a bit. And as the older children leave, like the two boys I took were among the last of the older children, she's going to try to focus on babies and toddlers.
Although I assume that other people saw her as a kind of a success story. Is she got that money and are perhaps doing the same thing? Are there others opening up these informal orphanages?
There are. And there have been people, you know, more affluent women in Addis Ababa reached out to her, the mayor's wife, you know, a famous singer. So she did open the way for a person to defy the stigma and say, what does stigma mean to me? These children need a mother.
When this book came out last year, you did the book tour. And now you're doing it again. Does it feel odd talking about a book that you must have written 2 or 3 years ago?
I actually finished it just almost. We had to push it to the very end because the story changed so dramatically. So I really only finished it, I guess, a little over a year ago. No, I love the book so much. I really just want to write this book again. I have no idea what to do next. This is the story.
You haven't written anything since?
I've written magazine articles, but not another book. This is the book to me. This is the story. The children, millions of children, is the story.
Well, you know, the situation in South Africa remains dire because of government policies.
Yeah.
Even though the drugs are available, there are people in high levels of government who don't believe that the antiretrovirals really work. Do you think somebody else should be going out there and doing a similar story
about South Africa? Yeah, that's a truly bizarre story. President Mbeki's attempt to defy Western authority led him down the path of the AIDS deniers, who said HIV didn't lead to AIDS. And even at the International AIDS Conference in Toronto, when countries from all over the world were presenting their therapies, their clinics, and so on, South Africa's booth was displaying things like turnips. Yeah.
Garlic,
sweet potatoes.
Melissa Faye Green, There Is No Me Without You, One Woman's Odyssey to Rescue Her Country's Children, is now available in a trade paperback from Bloomsbury. And as always, it's a great pleasure to have you on the show.
Me too. Thank you.
And I thank you so much for telling us about her. And I hope that she isn't too tired now.